Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to another Friday, a Friday edition that we are calling Ask Dr. Nurse Mama, and I am answering your questions that have been coming in, and keep those questions coming. You can watch for prompts that we'll give you on social media. You can go through my website at drnursemama.com. And I'm also always talking to parents and kids in the community who will ask me questions about just current trends and current threats. And listen, I say this every time we have an Ask Dr. Nurse Mama show, but I'm going to say it again. It can be really easy to succumb to fear-based parenting and to think, oh my goodness, this, you know, there are just all of these evil forces in the world that are out to get my kids. Let's batten down the hatches. Let's live off the grid. Like, let's just, you know, go extreme here. And the important thing to know is that our kids are watching. They are watching in how we respond to these threats. And they need to see our confidence in our relationship with them, our confidence in their decision-making, even when maybe you're not feeling it so much inside, but that means a lot to our kids, knowing that, hey, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have difficult times. You are going to need grace. You're going to need do-overs, all of those things. And our goal as parents is to be their coach, to make sure that that practice environment is safe, that it's safe to fail. That is really what we need to do, is to set up the boundaries that creates a place for them to fail. They need to fall. They need to figure out how they mess up and how they start over. But we just want that stakes to be very small in that. So the harm is small. And that can be a difficult thing of knowing where the boundaries are. Now, I am convinced, parents, that the healthiest parenting comes through just doing that. We talk about a lot of kind of parenting. We talk about helicopter parenting and lawnmower and bulldozer and gatekeeping. But I'm just encouraging you to pursue healthy parenting, to pursue healthy relationships, to know that everything is not always going to be perfect. You're going to mess up. Your kids are going to mess up. But if you have that foundational relationship there, if your communication skills are good, I am convinced that there is no challenge that you can't get through together. I am really convinced of that. And as we know more, we do better. We do the best we can with what we know. But if you are on a journey to intentionally invest in your parenting, I promise you that that is an investment that pays off dividends from generation to generation to generation. So before I answer some of these questions that you have, I want to remind you that in my book, Behind Closed Doors, A Guide for Parents and Teens to Navigate Through Life's Toughest Issues, there is a four-step communication model in that. I've talked about this a little bit, but I want to revisit this as we approach the new year. And we're thinking about New Year's resolutions. Now, a lot of New Year's resolutions are, I'm going to exercise more, I'm going to eat better, I'm going to be more faithful and reading my Bible, all those things. And by day three, like, we've fallen off the wagon. And I think that we need to set realistic goals. Now, if your New Year's resolution is to invest in your parenting journey, there's really not a lot of ways you can fail at that, because maybe one week you do great and then one week you don't have as much time, but you go back to it. One way that you can invest in your parenting journey is simply by listening to this radio show. Every day we are on to give you hope and encouragement and to teach you new skills, new tools that you can put in your tool belt. Now, I started my own parenting journey with precious little. And in fact, I'd probably say the tools that I had were more tools for harm than for help. But I've learned a lot along the way. And that's the whole purpose of this Dr. Nurse Mama radio show, to use my professor brain, my hands-on nursing experience, and my heart as a mom to be a guide on the side for parents who are navigating things that seem absolutely impossible. The cultural tidal wave of what seems like toxic sludge coming over our kids. We can resist it. We can find hope for healthy. So let me go back to this four-step communication model. Now, this is something that I've adapted from a professional tool that I use in talking to kids. And I really feel like I'm a kid whisperer now. Like, I can talk to any kid about anything, but it's taken a lot of practice and it's really not that mysterious. So, four steps here. It's called love. And it's not just for teens, it's for any stage of parenting that you're in. Love, L-O-V-E. Let me walk you through these four steps. The first step is listen with your face. Now, so often parents, this is a reminder and a reminder to myself. We do not listen to our kids with our face. So as I'm going to talk about some of these health threats and initiating conversation, if you don't do anything else except stop what you're doing, put your phone down, pull over to a parking lot, give your child your face and say, this sounds important. I want you to have my whole face, because we have all been in that situation where we've been talking to our spouse or maybe our kid and we say, you're not listening. And they say, yes, I am. And they repeat back to you everything that you just said, but somehow it still doesn't feel good. You don't feel like they heard you. Maybe they're listening, but they didn't hear you. We want to make our kids feel heard. Now, the other thing too, I can tell you about science is that it takes about 20 seconds of eye contact for our kids' brains to release oxytocin, a chemical that makes them feel bonded to us. Give them eye contact. By the way, the same works with a hug. And I will tell my kids, ooh, it looks like you had a bad day. I think you need a 20-second hug. Now, most of the time they don't say, oh, yay, that sounds great. They resist. I hug tighter, I squeeze, and I tell them, listen, I'm gonna squeeze you until you have that oxytocin release and you will feel better. And sometimes I'll tell you, they will come to me and say, I think I need one of those long hugs. So just remember that it's our job to love them well. It's not their job to validate our efforts. So step one, L, listen with your face. Step two, O, offer open-ended questions. So often, parents, we lead in this discussion space with lecturing. You cannot lecture your way to leverage behavioral change. You cannot argue your way into right relationship. We've had past guests on, Larry Fowler, who spoke to grandparents, and Jim Burns, who spoke to parents, who said, unsolicited advice will be received as criticism. So then you wonder why our kids feel like we're critiquing them the whole time when we're really giving them good advice and we know the pitfalls that they are going to face. We know what they're going to see, but we have to help them get in a space that's ready to receive that. And one way to do that is to start with questions, to cultivate a sense of curiosity. So just asking, how do you feel about that? What do you think would be a good thing to do? What's the hardest thing about this situation? All of those open-ended conversations, open-ended questions are really, really helpful. Step three, V, in the love your kid model, that is validate their emotion. Emotions in and of themselves are not wrong. Jesus had emotions. He was angry. He was tired. He was hungry. He felt betrayed. All of those things are really, it's really important for us to see our kids. So we need to get in the practice of saying, I can see this makes you feel very fill in the blank. I can't tell you how much that can just make their pressure release, just to feel like you see them and you hear them. You have made them seen, you've made them heard, and you make them feel loved by just saying, I can see this is really upsetting. I give the example in my book that if they make a bad grade, but they haven't studied all night, you can say, I told you so. That's perfectly your right to say, or you could say, it never feels good to get a bad grade. I'm so sorry. This is upsetting. You're not validating their lack of studying. You're just validating that, yeah, it feels crummy in the moment. Step four, E, explore next steps together. So this is your way, your four-step plan to build a bridge of communication. And if you do that, you can talk to your kids about anything. Now, it doesn't mean that it's never going to be awkward, because there are a lot of conversations we have that are awkward, but you know what kids value? They value authenticity. They value you being real and acknowledging even that awkwardness. I realize this is awkward, but I love you enough and I feel this is important enough that I'm just going to push through. I've often shared the story of my son having a conversation about something I'm about to talk about, and he put his hoodie up over his head as I was talking to him, and as I was speaking, he pulled the drawstring tighter and tighter and tighter until I was just having a conversation with his nose. And through that muffled hoodie, I could see his lips moving, saying, we will never speak of this again. But you know what? We did speak of it again, and he knew there was an open door. Now that we've talked through some of the basics, and I know I've said it again, but I need to remind myself as well. When we talk about our kids, talk about things with our kids, those are the principles. Now, let me get to some of your questions. Last week, I didn't have time to finish answering the questions that I had about some relationships. Now, I'm going to go back and revisit this. I talked a little bit last week, if you were listening, about a very common relationship trend that I'm seeing today, and that's called situationships. And this is just a casual, commitment-free situation where it's not really defined whether they're dating or they're friends, but they're basically just at each other's beck and call. Now, this can be a friend kind of situation, and it basically means, hey, if something better comes along, like, I'm going to take that, but if nothing else happens, well, I guess, you know, you'll do. That is not a healthy way for kids to have a friendship or a relationship. And so I really think over this Christmas break, when your kids are home from school, it's a great time to be able to initiate conversation, whether they're in first grade or their first year in college, to talk about friendships, to cultivate those friendships, and to support those positive relationships in their life with a strong, healthy friend group. Now, when they're younger, it's great to be able to engage with your kids' friends. So whether that's a play date at a local park, whether that is having their friends over if they're older, but a lot of times when friends come over, the parents kind of disappear. But it is perfectly okay to have an activity where you are engaged with them. Now, this may be sitting at the dinner table with them and talking about questions. Now, this is usually how this goes down. Your own kids will be like, oh my gosh, mom, like, can we go? Oh, stop talking. This is so embarrassing. But usually the kids, the friends, they're eating up that kind of attention. They are more than willing to engage in conversation, and they really appreciate being seen and being known, being heard, being loved. This is the cry of every human heart. And so it's really important to cultivate those relationships. Make it easy for your child to have those relationships. So you offer and say, hey, you know, I know you've been hanging out with this person. I know you might miss them over the Christmas break. I was thinking about, what if we had them over for whatever that might be? Now, if your budget allows, maybe you take them out to do an outing. Maybe that's mini golf or something like that, where you can engage and show them that you are invested in that healthy relationship and say, I really like it. What I like about you when you're around this person is your honesty. I really like how this friend is so nice to your siblings. That's really great. And emphasize the positive rather than picking on those negative friendships and saying, yeah, I don't want you hanging around them. I don't think you should be hanging around them. Are they going to come over? Instead, flip the narrative and help them find those positive ones. Communicate messages of value and build their self-esteem and let them know they are a good friend and worthy of that in return. Now, when we come back, we'll talk about some scarier elements, including cyberstalking and over-the-counter birth control coming your way in 2024. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to an Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday. I love answering your questions. That is pretty much what my whole book is, was answering parent questions that I had about the 12 top things that I'm seeing in pediatric practice today. My book is called Behind Closed Doors, A Guide for Parents and Teens to Navigate Through Life's Toughest Issues. And at the beginning of each chapter, I give a clinical scenario to show you this is exactly how I came face to face with this issue, the questions that parents had, and how I answered them. In the first segment, we talked about how to talk to your kids about these issues. Now I'm going to continue on in talking about some of those specific things. So when your kids, we'll go back to friendships. I was talking about situationships, which are really unhealthy friendships. These are friends where you're really not invested in each other at all, and that you see, and I think every parent can feel the pain of seeing your kid invest in a friendship that is just not returned. Your kid is thinking about their birthday or thinking about doing something really special for them, and then they're excluded. They don't get invited, and it plays all out on social media, which even if our kids don't have social media, somebody in their friend circle does. They'll tell them about it. This is really hard to do. And I think more than any time ever, we need as parents to help our kids invest in friendships. The other thing that we are seeing is that kids don't know how to relate in person. And a lot of times they're much more comfortable with online digital interactions rather than in-person ones. And so listen, parents, we have got, if you are millennial, you have some too. Gen X, we have some mad social skills. And baby boomers even more than us, because baby boomers are the ones who are gathering at the water cooler to talk about their day, whereas Gen Z is not. They're texting the person in the classroom, the office, the dorm room right next to them. So we can use and partner our old school social skills with their new worldview to really be able to form a powerful partnership on developing healthy friendships and relationships. So listen, parents, if your teen is looking at, they want a friend, if they're saying, I really, really need and want a friend in my life, or if your teen is really wanting a dating relationship or young adult, help them sometime over this break to actually write a list. If they express that to you, they say, I want a friend, say, what is important to you in a friend? And make that list of desired characteristics and then help them identify people in their circle who have those. Or if they tell you, I have this potential friend or I have this potential relationship, ask them, how do they match up with the things that you want to see in that? Now, let's go ahead and start to move towards parents of teens. If you're a parent of a younger one, hang on, because this will be here before you know it. I am seeing kids want to engage in romantic relationships earlier and earlier. My daughter was in fifth grade when Instagram became all the rage, and I will never forget looking at her class roster and looking up these kids on Instagram with her, because she was trying to show me that every kid in her class did have Instagram. But you see status things on Facebook like, in a relationship. And I'm thinking, you're 10, like you're 10. How is this happening? So know that this comes more quickly than you think it will. So what's really important, I think the first thing, a lot of times this question comes up very often, how old should kids be when they start to date? And my answer is always, always, it depends. I don't ever think it should be a year. I know that, you know, when I was growing up, my parents would say, okay, you can date when you're 16. And man, we would wait. All my friends, we would wait for that 16th birthday. And that was what we tried to plan was, hey, we can do this now. So let's plan a date. And I think it's so much more important to make it milestone based, to make it character based, not age based. And to say, okay, you can start to date when you achieve these certain milestones, when you have these things. And you've got to talk about what that is because it's different for every kid. But you can start to create those boundaries now. What will it look like if someone wants to ask you out? Will you require the other person, like if somebody wants to date your daughter, does your daughter need to know that they're going to have to talk to her dad? That might be a rule that families have. Talk about it beforehand. This makes it so much easier. So as let's just use that example of a daddy-daughter relationship. So as that daughter is starting to have people in her social circle that maybe this guy's interested in me, she can tell him up front. If he asked her out, well, you're going to have to ask my dad. Not, okay, well, let me go see what my parents say. Mom, can I go out with this boy? Well, he's going to have to ask your dad. What? Why? Oh my gosh, that's so embarrassing. No, I can never do that. But if they know these are the expectations up front, where you can go, whether or not you have to have a chaperone, what your curfew is going to be, those things are so important. Now, while we're talking about curfews, let me digress for a second and say that's another question that I get all the time is what curfew did you have for your kids? Now, listen up. This is going to be a little bit shocking and maybe a little upsetting for some of you, but I've never had a curfew with any of my kids. Never. I know. How in the world, right? My kids are now 20, 18, 16, and 14. We still don't have a curfew. Let me tell you some things that I actually don't like about curfews. Curfews are time-based instead of experience-based. And if you have a curfew, then they're going to want to be out until that time. So if you say you can stay out till 11, they're going to think, what experiences can I cram into this time frame that I have? And I really don't like that. A time boundary says, how much time can I spend at this outing with these people? By contrast, a relationship boundary says, is this an outing where I want to spend my time with these people? A curfew can create arguments and unnecessary negotiations over time rather than activity. Can I break curfew? Why are you so strict? But my friend's curfew is this. A curfew also focuses on time spent rather than what happened during that time elapsed. Let me give you an example of this. So it gives teens an invisible advantage as they walk through the door that says, well, hey, I was home on time, right? Why are you asking me about what I did? I got home on time. I followed the rule. And if your teen gets in a situation over their heads and they want to leave early, also curfews can be awkward because they say, why are you leaving? Your curfew's not till 11. Why are you leaving? Rather than just making it a norm to leave whenever you feel like the experience is over. A relational approach to curfew is based on trust. It teaches teens to choose how to spend their time, not how much time to spend. Did you catch that? That's a really big difference. A relational approach teaches teens to choose how to spend their time, not how much time to spend. It alleviates arguing about time limits and focuses instead on behavior limits, and it gives your teens an out to leave early. So early on, I had a conversation with my teens to create some relationship boundaries instead of a curfew. And on friends, I would say, okay, is this a group of people who bring out the best in you? Is this a group of people that, you know, you want to be around, that you enjoy being around and who have mutual care and concern? When they had an invitation, we would look at that relationship boundary and say, okay, is this a safe situation? And that's the bottom line minimum. It has to be safe. The second would be, is this a positive situation? Is this a good use of my time? Then I'll teach them to think about the priority. Okay, these are friends I want to hang out with. This is a good invitation. I'd like to do this activity. Then you have to think on priorities. Have I spent enough time with my family? Am I caught up on studying? Do I need to rest so I'm ready for work or my job? So do I have the right priority? And if they think, yes, I'm caught up on everything, I don't have any homework assignments due, I've spent time with my family, then we go to logistics. Do you have a safe way to get there and back? Is there a chance this group could unexpectedly change plans? And if so, what will you do? In practice, we look at the city set legal curfew. That's non-negotiable, period. And I'm really surprised at how many parents are so blasé about that. They just say, yeah, you know, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Just come home afterwards. I always teach my kids, we're going to follow the legal curfew set by the city. And the time that I expect them home is based on the activity proposed by my teen and agreed to by me. So they'll say, we're going to the football game. It should be over around 10:30. I'll be home by 10:45. And if that changes, I will let you know and I'll call and ask for permission. And then they know I have access to their location to see where they are, although I confess I rarely have to use it. But they always call me or text me before they leave and let me know they're headed home. That's non-negotiable so that I know and I expect them. The other thing, parents, is that I always wait up. Always. Sometimes it's just, oh my goodness, thank goodness you're home because I'm so tired. I'm going to bed. I hope you had fun. I've looked in your eyeballs. I think everything's okay. But other nights, and honestly, these are my favorites, it turns into a 3-hour chat on the floor of my office under my desk in my office. And I'm not mad about that. So those are things to talk about in curfews. Now, other things in dating relationships, let's get a little more serious here. We are seeing a rise in cyberstalking or stalking on campuses. And I actually got an alert about this where I work. And universities always should take this matter. Parents should take this matter seriously because of the ability for people to really stalk your child online. And the 18 to 24 year olds have the highest rate of stalking among adults. Part of this is because they have predictable routines, they have limited places to go, they have shared classes, and they have more electronic access. So this is something that, you know, if your child thinks that somebody is following them online, constantly knows where they are, constantly shows up where they are being, and they're unexpected and they're unwelcome, this is a pretty serious issue. Now, if your child goes to a school or a university, the first thing to do is to go to that school or university because most states require some laws regarding bullying and stalking to see what resources are available to you, what they know about this other person, and how they can help teach and make your child be safe. If you're really concerned about safety, this is something that I don't mess around with. Stalking is a very serious indicator of a potential mental health concern. And that means an unstable situation, an unsafe situation, and you should get law enforcement involved. But prevention is teaching your kids about healthy relationships, what we've been talking about, how to form them, how to recognize them, teaching them that healthy relationships are built on trust, honesty, respect, equality, and compromise. And kids need to see those healthy relationship behaviors. So talking about them even among your family, saying, hey, this is a healthy relationship indicator between me and your dad. I will tell them that all the time. Like, do you see where we're bickering here and we're arguing about, you know, where we're going to eat or what show we're going to watch? That's normal. What this is concerning. This is concerning behavior. And so we also need to raise our kids to be assertive, to speak up for themselves, to say that this is making me uncomfortable. I want you to stop following me on social media. You're not welcome to come here. I don't want you to come and visit me anymore. We need to teach them to say those things and to recognize warning signs of an unhealthy relationship. Now, those include jealousy, controlling behavior, excessive texting or monitoring, or asking to keep some aspects of the relationship secret. Those things are all warning signs. So talk to your kids about those and say, if you ever wonder about an aspect of your relationship that makes you uncomfortable or you might think is unhealthy, come and talk to me about that. Now, if your kid has not come to talk to you about that, maybe because they don't know how or they're afraid you'll cut off access to that relationship, look for signs like changes in their mood, changes in their sleep or eating patterns, withdrawing from friends, their school performance is going down, or they're not interested in their favorite sport or activity. When you see those kinds of changes, talk to them, initiate conversation, say, what is going on? And they may not open up to you the first time, but just continue to be physically, emotionally, and mentally present in their life. If you continue to show interest, you will build trust so that they can tell you about that. There's so much more to say, but the last question I want to answer before we go to break is about over-the-counter birth control. Yes, this is happening. The FDA announced earlier this year that O-pill, an oral contraceptive available by prescription for about the last 50 years, is going to be sold over the counter. This has not been enacted yet, but we are expecting this in early 2024. Now, why do you need to know about this? Because there is no age restriction, and that means teens can purchase it over the counter without any restrictions. So here are some facts about this. This birth control pill is a mini pill. That means progestin only. It has fewer side effects than combination estrogen or progestin. But there are contraindications and precautions, including heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, blood clots, migraine, seizures, and others. And the Catholic Church has expressed concerns about cancer risks, delay in diagnosis of cancer, infections, and exploitation by traffickers. There's no set price, and there has to be a pharmacist on duty to answer when questions are sold. So this is something that we will be talking about more. And so just keep your ear open for information about this. Look for an opening to talk to your kid in a healthy way. It's something we'll revisit again. When we come back, I'll be sharing some stories for the holiday. Don't go away.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome back to Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday, where I answer questions from listeners, from my patients, from people in my community, asking me all about new things that seem to be coming up every day, or maybe old things that need a reminder. Today, we've been talking a lot about relationships, friendships, and recognizing healthy relationships, cultivating those for our kids, and recognizing some potentially harmful behaviors. Now, I finished the last segment talking about over-the-counter birth control. Stay tuned, because next week I'll be talking even more about that and giving you some more details. In our last bit of time together, I want to tell you that so often I am asked, how do you have such a great relationship with your kids? And you know what? I do. I love my kids. They are my favorite people in the whole world, besides you, honey. I know you're listening. Of course, you are my favorite. You gave me my kids, but they're getting to the age where they're just fun to be around, because I'm seeing the fruits of so many seeds that we planted so long ago. And I absolutely love that. Now, one of the things that I have used as a parenting tactic is traditions. And so in answering that question, I have a lot, probably more traditions than I should. But you know what? It's okay, because some traditions are for a season and some are for forever. And traditions have made us have an identity as a family, knowing that we always do this. And I tell you, we cannot wait to be together at Christmas. And I do not take it lightly that even in the summer, I was thinking it was a Friday night and I have four teenagers at the time who all wanted to be together spending family time. Now, that's not something that comes without a lifetime, honestly, journey of intention. Our family is not perfect by far. My kids would be the first to tell you about my failures, and I would encourage them to do so because I have them and I learn from them. We fight, we argue, we complain, we disagree, but we work through it, and that is a healthy relationship. And I want so badly for all of you out there listening to have the relationship with your family that you always dreamed of, especially with your kids. I can't promise that it'll be perfect, but I can promise that investing in this journey will be a journey worthwhile. Now, one of my favorite traditions is reading out loud to my kids holiday stories. And last week, I read you a story of Marty and Kenny, one of my favorite stories. It's just about a kid that gets hurt that God uses for healing, and the nurse in me loves that. And today I'm going to read you one more story. This is out of a book called Christmas Stories for the Heart. It's the same book I read out of last week. This story is called The Gold and Ivory Tablecloth by Howard Shade. And it actually came from the 1954 Reader's Digest. So some of you still have a lot of copies of that in your house, and I want to come over and read them. But I digress. Here's our story for today. At Christmas time, men and women everywhere gather in their churches to wonder anew at the greatest miracle the world has ever known. But the story I like best to recall was not a miracle. Not exactly. It happened to a pastor who was very young. His church was very old. Once long ago, it had flourished. Famous men had preached from its pulpit, prayed before its altar. Rich and poor alike worshipped there and built it beautifully. Now the good days had passed from the section of town where it stood. But the pastor and his young wife believed in their rundown church. They felt that with paint, hammer, and faith, they could get it in shape. Together they went to work. But in late December, a severe storm whipped through the river valley, and the worst blow fell on the little church. A huge chunk of rain-soaked plaster fell out of the inside wall just behind the altar. Sadly, the pastor and his wife swept away the mess, but they could not hide the ragged hole in the wall. The pastor looked at it and had to remind himself quickly, "Thy will be done," but his wife wept. Christmas is only 2 days away. That afternoon, the dispirited couple attended the auction held for the benefit of a youth group. The auctioneer opened a box and shook out of its fold a handsome gold and ivory lace tablecloth. It was a magnificent item, nearly 15 feet long, but it too dated from a long vanished era. Who today had any use for such a thing? There were a few half-hearted bids, and then the pastor was seized with what he thought was a great idea. He bid on it for $6.50. He carried the cloth back to the church and tacked it up on the wall behind the altar. It completely hid the hole, and the extraordinary beauty of its shimmering handiwork cast a fine holiday glow over the chancel. It was a great triumph, and happily he went back to preparing for his Christmas sermon. Just before noon on the day of Christmas Eve, the pastor was opening the church. He noticed a woman standing in the cold at the bus stop. "The bus won't be here for 40 minutes," he called, and he invited her into the church to get warm. She told him that she had come from the city that morning to be interviewed for a job as governess to the children of one of the wealthy families in town, but she had been turned down. A war refugee, her English was imperfect. The woman sat down in a pew and chafed her hands and rested. After a while, she dropped her head and prayed. She looked up as the pastor began to adjust the great ivory and gold lace cloth across the hole. She rose suddenly and walked up the steps of the chancel. She looked at the tablecloth, and the pastor smiled and started to tell her about the storm damage, but She didn't seem to listen. She took up a fold of the cloth and rubbed it between her fingers. "It is mine," she said. "It is my banquet cloth." She lifted the corner and showed the surprised pastor that there were initials monogrammed on it. "My husband had the cloth made especially for me in Brussels. There could not be another like it." For the next few moments, the woman and the pastor talked excitedly together. She explained that she was Viennese, that she and her husband had opposed the Nazis and decided to leave the country. They were advised to go separately. Her husband put her on a train for Switzerland. They planned that he would join her as soon as he could arrange to ship their household goods across the border. She never saw him again. Later, she heard that he had died in a concentration camp. "I've always felt that it was my fault to leave without him," she said. "Perhaps these years of wandering have been my punishment." The pastor tried to comfort her and urged her to take the cloth with her. She refused. Then she went away. As the church began to fill on Christmas Eve, it was clear that the cloth was going to be a great success. It had been skillfully designed to look its best by candlelight. After the service, the pastor stood in the doorway. Many people told him that the church looked beautiful. One gentle-faced, middle-aged man, he was the local clock and watch repairman, looked rather puzzled. "It is strange," he said. "Many years ago, my wife, God rest her, and I owned such a cloth in our home in Vienna. My wife put it on the table." Here he smiled. "Only when the bishop came to dinner." The pastor suddenly became very excited. He told the jeweler about the woman who had been in the church earlier in the day. The startled jeweler clutched the pastor's arm. "Can it be? Does she live?" Together, the two got in touch with the family who had interviewed her. And then, in the pastor's car, they started for the city. And as Christmas Day was born, this man and his wife, who had been separated through so many saddened Yuletides, were reunited. To all who heard this story, the joyful purpose of the storm that knocked a hole in the wall of the church was now quite clear. Of course, people said it was a miracle, and I think you will agree, it was the season for it. Now, friends, why do I tell this story? I tell this story because for some of you, you've had a hole knocked in the wall of your relationship, of your situation, and all you see is the damage and what is to come. And I think the thing that you absolutely would not feel is joy. Who feels joy in those kinds of situations when you experience hurt and trauma and loss, and you're looking at that hole in the wall of your Christmas, and you're thinking, does God see this? Does God know this? And there's some of you out there who are thinking, no, everything is great. And for those of you, let me tell you, the world needs your stories. Those people who are looking at the hole in the wall, they need your stories of hope. And I hope that in this moment, even right now, that you will join me in praying for those who are devastated, who are separated. And for those who Christmas is going great, I pray that the eyes of your heart would be enlightened to see those around you who need that hope. And to those of you who are struggling, that it seems everything is going wrong. That hole in the wall is relationship conflict that just never seems to get resolved. You can think about just the trauma, the sadness of it. But I want to share with you a scripture. This is from 2 Corinthians. "We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed day by day. Is that you, friend? Is that where you're feeling going into this holiday season? Do you feel pressed on every side? Know that you are not crushed. Do you feel perplexed, but you're not in despair? Do you feel persecuted? You are never abandoned. And if you feel struck down, you are not destroyed. And I pray for you in this Christmas season from Romans 15:13. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in Him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. I myself am convinced, my brothers and sisters, that you yourselves are full of goodness, filled with knowledge, and competent to instruct one another. This is where that partnership comes in place. And as we think of Advent this week and we think about joy, joy is not a happiness. Joy is not feeling, you know, just absolutely giddy and smiling and cheerful. Joy is contentment in our circumstances. Joy is knowing that all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose. And when I was in church this Sunday, we sang not a Christmas song, but we sang a song called Graves into Gardens. And I was struck by those lyrics. And that is what God does. We serve a God who turns graves into gardens. He turns bones into armies. He turns seas into highways. That is amazing. He turns mourning to dancing. He gives beauty for ashes. He turns shame into glory. That is the God that we serve. And I was thinking about the lyrics saying, the God of the mountain is the God of the valley. There's not a place that His mercy and grace won't find us again. And so I know that some of you are going into this holiday season and you're just feeling ill-equipped. You're thinking, I don't know how God will be there for me. But just remember that joy is not dependent on our circumstance. Jesus brings joy, shalom, or peace into the chaos of our broken lives. He does. I really believe that He does. And if provision is stripped, if we read from, this is what our pastor read to us on Sunday from Habakkuk 3, verses 17 and 18, though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls. And maybe that's you reading it. There are no gifts under the tree. There are no people sitting with you on Christmas morning. There are no miraculous restored relationships. Verse 18 says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. And sometimes God lets us see the ends of those stories like the tablecloth quickly, and we see quickly that God has a plan. And sometimes it's years down the road before we can pull back and see the beautiful tapestry that He is creating. And maybe you're thinking, yeah, that sounds good, Jessica, but how do I choose joy? Well, I think of the words of the song, Jesus loves me. We are weak, but He is strong. Joy doesn't come with circumstance. It comes in your heart. Know that I'll be praying for you, that you will be filled with hope and joy this season. I'll see you next time.